Chapter 2. Requin. 1. Though Locke saw that Jean remained as unsettled by their experience in the night market as he was, they spoke no further of the matter. There was a job to be done, and they were up at the crack of dusk the next day. The close of the working day for honest men and women in Tal Verar was just the beginning of theirs. It had been strange at first, getting used to the rhythm of a city where the sun simply fell beneath the horizon like a quiescent murder victim each night, without the glow of false light to mark its passing. But Tal Verar had been built to different tastes or needs than Camor, and its elder glass simply mirrored the sky, raising no light of its own. Their suite at the Villa Candessa was high-ceilinged and opulent. At 5 silver volani a night, nothing less was to be expected. Their fourth-floor window overlooked a cobbled courtyard in which carriages, studded with lanterns and outriding mercenary guards, came and went with echoing clatters. "Bonds, Magi," muttered Jean as he tied on his neckcloths before a looking-glass. "I'll never hire one of the bastards to do so much as heat my tea, not if I live to be richer than the Duke of Camor." "Now there's a thought," said Locke, who was already dressed and sipping coffee. A full day of sleep had done wonders for his head. "If we were richer than the Duke of Camor, we could hire a whole pack of them and give them instructions to go lose themselves on a desolate fucking island somewhere." "I don't think the gods made any islands desolate enough for my tastes." Jean finished his neckcloths with one hand and reached for his breakfast with the other. One of the odder services the Villa Candessa provided for its long-term guests was its likeness cakes, little frosted simulacra fashioned after the guests by the inn's Camor-trained pastry sculptor. On a silver tray beside the looking-glass, a little sweetbread lock, with raisin eyes and almond-butter blonde hair, sat beside a rounder Jean with dark chocolate hair and beard. The baked Jean's legs were already missing. A few moments later, Jean was brushing the last buttery crumbs from the front of his coat. "Alas, poor Locke and Jean." "They died of consumption," said Locke. "I do wish I could be there to see it when you talk to Requin and Selendri, you know." "Can I trust you to still be in Tal Verar by the time I get finished?" He tried to leaven the question with a smile, only partially succeeding. "You know I won't go anywhere," said Jean. "I'm still not sure it's wise, but you know I won't." "I do. I'm sorry." He finished his coffee and set the cup down. "And my chat with Requin isn't going to be that terribly interesting." "Nonsense. I heard a smirk in your voice. Other people smirk when their work is finished. You grin like an idiot just before yours really begins." "Smirking? I'm as slack-cheeked as a corpse. I'm just looking forward to being done with it. Tedious business. I anticipate a dull meeting." "Dull meeting, my ass. Not after you walk straight up to the lady with the brass bloody hand and say, 'Excuse me, madam, but—'" 2. "I have been cheating," said Locke, "steadily. At every single game I've played since my partner and I first came to the Sinspire 2 years ago." Receiving a piercing stare from Selendri was a curious thing. Her left eye was nothing but a dark hollow, half covered with a translucent awning that had once been a lid. Her single good eye did the work of two, and damned if it wasn't unnerving. "Are you deaf, madam? Every single one. Cheating. All the way up and down this precious Sinspire, cheating floor after floor, taking your other guests for a very merry ride."
"I wonder," she said in her slow, witchy whisper, "if you truly understand what it means to say that to me, Master Costa. Are you drunk?"
"I'm as sober as a suckling infant."
"Is this something you've been put up to?"
"I'm completely serious," said Locke, "and it's your master I would speak to about my motivations, privately."
The sixth floor of the Sin Spire was quiet. Locke and Selendri were alone, with four of Requin's uniformed attendants waiting about 20 feet away. It was still too early in the evening for this level's rarefied crowd to have finished their slow, carousing migration up through the livelier levels. At the heart of the sixth floor was a tall sculpture within a cylinder of transparent elderglass. Though the glass could not be worked by human arts, there were literally millions of cast-off fragments and shaped pieces scattered around the world, some of which could be conveniently fitted to human use. There were elderglass scavenging guilds in several cities, capable of filling special needs in exchange for exorbitant fees. Within the cylinder was something Locke could only describe as a copperfall. It was a sculpture of a rocky waterfall, taller than a man, in which the rocks were shaped entirely from silver Valani coins, and the water was a constant heavy stream of copper centira, thousands upon thousands of them. The clatter within the soundproof glass enclosure must have been tremendous, but for those on the outside the show proceeded in absolute silence. Some mechanism in the floor was catching the stream of coins and recirculating it up the back of the silver rocks. It was eccentric and hypnotic. Locke had never before known anyone to decorate a room with a literal pile of money.
"Master, you presume that I have one?"
"You know I mean Requin."
"He would be the first to correct your presumption violently."
"A private audience would give us a chance to clear up several misunderstandings, then."
"Oh, Requin will certainly speak to you very privately."
Selendri snapped the fingers of her right hand twice, and the four attendants converged on Locke. Selendri pointed up. Two of them took firm hold of his arms, and together they began to lead him up the stairs. Selendri followed a few steps behind. The seventh floor was dominated by another sculpture within an even wider elderglass enclosure. This one seemed to be a circle of volcanic islands, again built from silver Volani, floating in a sea of solid gold solari. Each of the silver peaks had a stream of gold coins bubbling from its top to fall back down into the churning, gleaming ocean. Requin's guards maintained a pace too vigorous for Locke to catch many more details of the sculpture or the room. They passed another pair of uniformed attendants beside the stairwell and continued up. At the heart of the eighth floor was a third spectacle within glass, the largest yet. Locke blinked several times and suppressed an appreciative chuckle. It was a stylized sculpture of Tal Verar. Silver islands nestled in a sea of gold coins. Standing over the model city, bestriding it like a god, was a life-sized marble sculpture of a man Locke recognized immediately. The statue, like the man, had prominent curving cheekbones that lent the narrow face a sense of mirth, plus a round protruding chin, wide eyes and large ears that seemed to have been jammed into the head at right angles. Requin, whose features bore a fair resemblance to a marionette put together in haste by a somewhat irate puppeteer. The statue's hands were held outward at the waist, spread forward, and from the flaring stone cuffs around them, two solid streams of gold coins were continually gushing onto the city below. Locke, staring, only avoided tripping over his own feet because the attendants holding him chose that moment to tighten their grip. Atop the eighth-floor stairs was a pair of lacquered wooden doors. Selendri strode past Locke and the attendants. To the left of the door was a small silver panel in the wall. Selendri slid her brass hand into it, let it settle into some sort of mechanism, and then gave it a half-turn to the left. There was a clatter of clockwork devices within the wall, and the doors cracked open.
"Search him,"
she said, as she vanished through the doors without turning around. Locke was rapidly stripped of his coat. He was then poked, prodded, sifted, and patted down more thoroughly than he'd been during his last visit to a brothel. His sleeve stiletto, a perfectly ordinary thing for a man of consequence to carry, was confiscated. His purse was shaken out, his shoes were slipped off, and one attendant even ran his hands through Locke's hair. When this process was finished, Locke, shoeless, coatless, and somewhat dishevelled, was given a less than gentle shove toward the doors Selendry had vanished through. Past them was a dark space not much larger than a wardrobe closet. A winding black iron staircase, wide enough for one person, rose up from the floor toward a square of soft yellow light. Locke padded up the stairs and emerged into Requin's office. This place took up the whole of the ninth floor of the Sin Spire, an area against the far wall, curtained off with silk drapes, probably served as a bedroom. There was a balcony door on the right-hand wall, covered by a sliding mesh screen. Locke could see a wide, darkened sweep of Tal Varar through it, so he presumed it looked east. Every other wall of the office, as he'd heard, was liberally decorated with oil paintings, nearly 20 of them around the visible periphery of the room, in elaborate frames of gilded wood, masterworks of the late Therin throne years, when nearly every noble at the Emperor's court had kept a painter or sculptor on the leash of patronage, showing them off like pets. Locke hadn't the training to tell one from another by sight, but rumour had it that there were two Morestras and a Ventathis on Requin's walls. Those two artists, along with all their sketches, books of theory and apprentices, had died centuries before, in the firestorm that had consumed the imperial city of Therim Pell. Selendry stood beside a wide wooden desk the colour of a fine coffee, cluttered with books and papers and miniature clockwork devices. A chair was pushed out behind it, and Locke could see the remnants of a dinner, some sort of fish on a white iron plate, paired with a half-empty bottle of pale golden wine. Selendry touched her flesh hand to her brass simulacrum, and there was a clicking noise. The hand folded apart like the petals of a gleaming flower. The fingers locked into place along the wrist and revealed a pair of blackened steel blades, 6 inches long, previously concealed at the heart of the hand. Selendry waved these like a claw and gestured for Locke to stand before the desk, facing it.
"Master Custer."
The voice came from somewhere behind him, within the silk-curtained enclosure.
"What a pleasure. Selendry tells me you've expressed an interest in getting killed."
"Hardly, sir. All I told your assistant was that I had been cheating steadily, along with my partner, at the games we've been playing in your Sin Spire, for nearly the last 2 years."
"Every game," said Selendry. "You said every single game."
"Ah, well," said Locke with a shrug. "It just sounded more dramatic that way. It was more like nearly every game."
"This man is a clown," whispered Selendry.
"Oh, no," said Locke. "Well, maybe occasionally, but not now." Locke heard footsteps moving toward his back across the room's hardwood floor.
"You're here on a bet," said Requin, much closer.
"Not in the way that you mean, no." Requin stepped around Locke and stood before him, hands behind his back, peering at Locke very intently. The man was a virtual twin of his statue on the floor below, perhaps a few pounds heavier, with the bristling curls of steel-grey hair atop his head receding more sharply. His narrow frock coat was crushed black velvet, and his hands were covered with brown leather gloves. He wore optics, and Locke was surprised to see that the glimmer he had taken for reflected light the night before was actually imbued within the glass. They glowed a translucent orange, giving a demonic cast to the wide eyes behind them. Some fresh, expensive alchemy Locke had never heard of, no doubt.
"Did you drink anything unusual tonight, Master Costa? An unfamiliar wine, perhaps?"
"Unless the water of Tal Varar itself intoxicates, I'm as dry as baked sand." Requin moved behind his desk, picked up a small silver fork, speared a white morsel of fish, and pointed at Locke with it.
So, if I'm to believe you, you've been successfully cheating here for 2 years, and aside from the sheer impossibility of that claim, now you just want to give yourself up to me. Case of conscience?
Not even remotely.
An earnest wish for an elaborate suicide?
I aim to leave this office alive.
Oh, you wouldn't necessarily be dead until you hit the cobblestones 9 stories below.
Perhaps I can convince you I'm worth more to you intact.
Requin chewed his fish before speaking again.
Just how have you been cheating, Master Costa?
Fast fingers work, mostly.
Really? I can tell a card sharp's fingers at a glance. Let's see that right hand of yours.
Requin held out his gloved left hand, and Locke hesitantly put his own forward, as though they might shake. Requin snatched Locke's right hand above the wrist and slammed it down atop his desk, but rather than the sharp rap Locke expected, his hand tipped aside some sort of disguised panel and slid into an aperture just beneath the surface of the desk. There was a loud clack of clockwork, and a cold pressure pinched his wrist. Locke jerked back, but the desk had swallowed his hand like the unyielding maw of a beast. Selendri's twin steel claws turned casually toward him, and he froze.
There now. Hands, hands, hands. They get their owners into such trouble, Master Costa. Selendri and I are two who would know.
Requin turned to the wall behind his desk and slid back a lacquered wood panel, revealing a long, shallow shelf set into the wall. Within were dozens of sealed glass jars, each holding something dark and withered. Dead spiders? No, Locke corrected himself. Human hands, severed, dried, and stored as trophies, with rings still gleaming on many of their curled and desiccated fingers.
Before we proceed to the inevitable, that's what we usually do,
Requin said in a lightly conversational tone.
Right hand, ta-ta. I've got it down to a pretty process. Used to have carpets in here, but the damn blood made for such a mess.
Very prudent of you. Locke felt a single bead of sweat start its slow slide down his forehead. I am as awed and chastised as you no doubt hoped. Might I have my hand back?
In its original condition? I doubt it. But answer some questions and we'll see. Now, fast fingers work, you say. But forgive me, my attendants are extremely adept at spotting card sharps.
I'm sure your attendants mean well. Locke knelt down before the desk, the most comfortable position possible, and smiled. But I can finger dance a live cat into a standard deck of 56 and slip it back out at leisure. Other players might complain about the noise, but they'd never spot the source.
Set a live cat on my desk, then.
It was a colourful figure of speech. Live cats, unfortunately, aren't in fashion as evening accessories for gentlemen of Tal Varrar this season.
Pity, but hardly a surprise. I've had quite a few dead men kneeling where you are now, offering colourful figures of speech and little else.
Locke sighed. Your boys removed my coat and my shoes, and if they'd patted me down any more thoroughly, they would have been fingering my liver. But what's this? He shook out his left sleeve and held up his left hand to show that a deck of cards had somehow fallen into it. Selendri shoved her blades toward Locke's throat, but Requin waved her back with a smile on his face. He can hardly kill me with a pack of cards, darling. Not bad, Master Costa. Now, said Locke, let's see. He held his arms straight out to the side, with the deck held firmly upright between his thumb and all four fingers. A twist of the wrist, a flick of his thumb, and the deck was cut. He began to flex and splay his fingers, steadily increasing his tempo until they moved like a spider taking fencing lessons. Cut and shuffle, cut and shuffle. He sliced the deck apart and slid it back together no fewer than a dozen times. Then, with one smooth flourish, he slapped it down on the desk and spread it in a long arc, displacing several of Requin's knick-knacks. "Pick one," said Locke. "Any one you like. Look at it, but don't show it to me." Requin did as instructed. While he peeked at the card he'd drawn, Locke gathered the rest of the deck with a reverse slide across Requin's desktop. He shuffled and cut once more, then split the deck and left half on top of the desk. "Go ahead and place your chosen card atop that half of the deck. Remember it now." When Requin returned the card, Locke slapped the other half of the deck down on top of it. Taking the full deck in his left hand, he did his one-handed cut and shuffle another 5 times. Then he slid the top card from the deck, the 4 of chalices, onto Requin's desk and smiled. "This, Master of the Sinspire, is your card." "No," said Requin with a smirk. "Shit!" Locke flicked out the next card from the top, the Sigil of the Sun. "Aha! I knew it was around there somewhere." "No," said Requin. "Damn me," said Locke, and he rapidly went through the next half dozen from the top of the deck. 8 of spires? 3 of spires? 3 of chalices? Sigil of the 12 gods? 5 of sabers? Shit! Mistress of flowers? Requin shook his head for each one. "Huh. Excuse me." Locke set the deck of cards down on Requin's desk, then fumbled at the clasp of his right sleeve with his left hand. After a few seconds, he slid the sleeve back above his elbow and reset the clasp. Suddenly, there was another deck of cards in his left hand. "Let's see. 7 of sabers? 3 of spires? No, we already did that one. 2 of chalices? 6 of chalices? Master of sabers? 3 of flowers? Damn, that deck wasn't so good after all." Locke set the second deck down beside the first on Requin's desk, appearing to scratch an itch near the slender black sash above his breeches, and then held up a third deck of cards. He grinned at Requin and raised his eyebrows. "This trick might work even better if I could have the use of my right hand." "Why, when you seem to be doing so well without it?" Locke sighed and flicked the top card from the new deck onto the growing pile atop the desk. 9 of chalices! Look familiar?" Requin laughed and shook his head. Locke set the third deck down beside the ones already on Requin's desk, stood up, and conjured another from somewhere in the vicinity of his breeches. "But your attendants would of course know," said Locke. "If I were loaded down with 4 concealed deck of cards, they being so adept at spotting something like that on a man with no jacket or shoes. Wait, 4? I may have miscounted." He produced a 5th deck from somewhere within his silk tunic, which joined the little tower of cards perched ever more precariously on the edge of the desk. "Surely I couldn't have hidden 5 decks of cards from your guards, Master Requin? 5 would be quite ridiculous. Yet there they are, though I'm afraid that's as good as it gets. To conjure more, I would have to begin producing them from somewhere disagreeable. And I'm sorry to say I don't seem to have the card you took. But wait, I do know where it might be found." He reached across Requin's desk, nudged the wine bottle at its base, and seemed to pluck a face-down card from underneath it. "Your card," he said, twirling it in the fingers of his left hand. 10 of sabers. "Well," laughed Requin, showing a wide arc of yellowing teeth below the far orange circles of his optics. "Very fine, very fine. And one-handed, too. But even if I grant that you could perform such tricks continuously in front of my attendants and my other guests, you and Master de Ferrer have spent a great deal of time at games that are more rigorously controlled than the open card tables. I can tell you how we beat those, too. Simply free me.
Why relinquish a clear advantage?
Then trade it to gain another. Free my right hand, said Locke, mustering every last bit of passionate sincerity he could pour into his words, and I shall tell you exactly why you must never again trust the security of your sin spire as it stands.
Requin stared down at him, laced his gloved fingers together, and finally nodded to Selendry. She withdrew her blades, though she kept them pointed at Locke, and pressed a switch behind the desk. Locke was suddenly free to stumble back to his feet, rubbing his right wrist.
Most kind, said Locke with a breeziness that was pure conjuring. Now, yes, we have played at quite a bit more than the open tables, but which games have we scrupulously avoided? Reds and blacks, count to 20, fair maiden's wish, all the games in which a guest plays against the sin spire rather than against another guest, games mathematically contrived to give the house a substantial edge.
Hard to make a profit otherwise, Master Costa.
Yes, and useless for the purposes of a cheat like myself. I need flesh and blood to fool. I don't care how much clockwork and how many attendants you throw in. In a game between guests, larceny always finds a way, sure as water pushes through a ship's seams.
More bold speech, said Requin. I admire glibness in the doomed, Master Costa. But you and I both know that there is no way to cheat at, say, Carousel Hazard, barring four-way complicity between the participants, which would render the game absolutely pointless.
True, there is no way to cheat the carousel or the cards, at least not here in your spire. But when one cannot cheat the game, one must cheat the players. Do you know what Bella Paranella is?
A soporific, expensive alchemy.
Yes, colourless, tasteless, and doubly effective when taken with liquor. Jerome and I were dusting our fingers with it before we handled our cards during each hand last night. Madame Corvalure has a well-known habit of eating and licking her fingers while playing. Sooner or later she was bound to take in enough of the drug to pass out.
Well, Requin looked genuinely taken aback. Selendry, do you know anything about this?
I can vouch for Corvalure's habits, at least, she whispered. It seemed to be her preferred method of irritating her opponents.
That it did, said Locke. It was quite a pleasure to see her do herself in.
I'll grant your story is remotely plausible, said Requin. I had been curious about Ismila's strange incapacity.
Indeed, the woman's built like an elderglass boathouse. Jerome and I had more empty vials than her side did. What she'd had wouldn't have gotten her eyelashes alone drunk, if not for the powder.
Perhaps. But let's discuss other games. What of blind alliances?
A game of blind alliances was played at a circular table with tall, specially designed barriers before each player's hands, so that everyone but the person directly across from them, their partner, could see at least some of their cards. Each silent participant set his or her right foot atop the left foot of the person on their right, all around the table, so no player could tap signals to a partner below the table. Partners, therefore, had to play by instinct and desperate inference, cut off from each other's sight, voice, and touch. A child's stratagem.
Jerome and I had special boots constructed, with iron-shod toes beneath the leather. We could slide our feet carefully out the backs of them, and the iron would continue to provide the sensation of a full boot to the person beside us. We could tap entire books to one another with the code we've got. Have you ever known anyone to dominate that game as thoroughly as we did?
You can't be serious.
I can show you the boots.
Well, you did seem to have an extraordinary run of luck. But what about billiards? You scored a rather famous victory against Lord Landreval. How could you have finessed that? My house provides all the balls, the sticks, and the handling.
Yes, so naturally those three things couldn't be fiddled. I paid Lord Landreval's consulting physician 10 solari for insight into his medical complaints. Turns out he's allergic to lemons. Jerome and I rubbed our necks, cheeks, and hands with sliced lemons each night before we played him, and used other oils to mostly cover up the scent. Half an hour in our presence, and he'd be so puffed up he could barely see. I'm not sure he ever realized what the problem was.
You say you won 1,000 solari with a few slices of lemon? Nonsense.
Of course, you're right. I asked politely if he'd lend me 1,000 solari, and he offered to let us publicly humiliate him at his favorite game out of the kindness of his heart. How often did Landreval lose before he met Jerome and myself? Once in 50 games?
Lemons. I'll be damned.
Yes. When you can't cheat the game, you'd best find a means to cheat the player. Given information and preparation, there's not a player in your spire Jerome and I can't dance along like a finger puppet. Hell, someone with my talents who knew enough about me could probably string me right along too.
It's a good story, Master Costa.
Requin reached across his desk and took a sip of his wine.
I suppose I can charitably believe at least some of what you claim. I suspected that you and your friend were no more merchant speculators than I am, but at my tower you may claim to be a duke or a three-headed dragon, provided you have solid credit. You certainly did before you stepped into my office this evening. Which brings us only to the most important question of all. Why the hell are you telling me this?
I need your attention.
You already had it.
I needed more than that. I needed you to understand my skills and my inclinations.
And now you have that as well, inasmuch as I accept your story. What exactly do you think that gets you?
A chance that what I'm going to say next will actually sink in.
Oh?
I'm not really here to take your guests for a few 1,000 solari here and a few 1,000 solari there, Requin. It's been fun, but it's secondary to my actual goal.
Locke spread his hands and smiled apologetically.
I've been hired to break into your vault. Just as soon as I find a way to haul everything in it from right out under your nose.
3. Requin blinked.
Impossible.
Inevitable.
This isn't legerdemain or lemons we're talking about now, Master Costa. Explain yourself.
My feet are beginning to hurt, said Locke, and my throat is somewhat dry.
Requin stared at him, then shrugged.
Celendry, a chair for Master Costa, and a glass.
Frowning, Celendry turned and took a finely wrought dark wood chair with a thin leather cushion from its place on the wall. She placed it behind Locke, and he settled into it with a smile on his face. She then bustled about behind him for a few moments and returned with a crystal goblet, which she passed to Requin. He picked up the wine bottle and poured a generous stream of red liquid into the goblet.
Red liquid?
Locke blinked and then relaxed.
Cameleona, The shifting wine, of course, one of the hundreds of Tal Verar's famous alchemical vintages. Requin passed him the goblet, then sat down atop his desk with his arms folded.
"To your health," said Requin. "It needs all the assistance it can get."
Locke took a long sip of the warm wine and allowed himself a few seconds of contemplation. He marvelled at the way the taste of apricots transmuted to the sharper flavour of slightly tart apple in mid-swallow. That sip had been worth 20 Volani, if his knowledge of the liquor market was still accurate. He gave a genuinely appreciative nod to Requin, who waved a hand nonchalantly.
"It cannot have escaped your attention, Master Costa, that my vault is the most secure in Tal Verar, the single most redundantly protected space in the entire city, in fact, not excepting the private chambers of the Archon himself." Requin tugged at the skin-tight leather of his right glove with the fingers of his left hand. "Or that it is encased within a structure of pristine elderglass, and accessible only through several layers of metallurgical and clockwork artifice that are, if I may be permitted to stroke my own breech-clout, peerless. Or that half the Priory Council regards it so highly that they entrust much of their personal fortunes to it."
"Of course," said Locke. "I congratulate you on a very flattering clientele. But your vault doors are guarded by gears, and gears are shaped by men. What one man locks, another will sooner or later unlock."
"I say again, impossible."
"And I correct you again, difficult. Difficult and impossible are cousins often mistaken for one another, with very little in common."
"You have more chance of giving birth to a live hippopotamus," said Requin, "than the best thief alive has of making it past the cordon drawn around my vault. But this is silly. We could sit here all night contrasting cock lengths. I say mine is 5 feet long, you say yours is 6, and shoots fire upon command. Let's hurry back to significant conversation. You admit that cheating the mechanisms of my games is out of the question. My vault is the most secure of all mechanisms. Am I therefore the flesh and blood you are presuming to fool?"
"It's possible this conversation represents me giving up that hope."
"What does cheating my guests have to do with plotting entry into my vault?"
"Originally," said Locke, "we gamed merely to blend in and cover our observance of your operations. Time passed, and we made no progress. The cheating was a lark to make the games more interesting."
"My house bores you?"
"Jerome and I are thieves. We've been sharping cards and lifting goods east and west, here to Camor and back again for years. Spinning carousels with the well-heeled is only amusing for so long, and we weren't getting far with our job, so we had to stay amused somehow."
"Job? Yes, you said you were hired to come here. Elaborate."
"My partner and I were sent here as the point men of something very elaborate. Someone out there wants your vault emptied. Not merely penetrated, but pillaged. Plucked and left behind like an empty honeycomb."
"Someone?"
"Someone. I haven't the faintest notion who. Jerome and I are dealt with through fronts. All of our efforts to penetrate them have been in vain. Our employer is as anonymous to us now as he was 2 years ago."
"Do you frequently work for anonymous employers, Master Costa?"
"Only the ones that pay me large piles of good cold metal. And I can assure you, this one has been paying us very well." Requin sat down behind his desk, removed his optics, and rubbed his eyes with his gloved hands.
"What's this new game, Master Costa? Why favour me with all of this?"
"I tire of our employer," I tire of Jerome's company. I find Talvera much to my taste, and I wish to arrange a new situation for myself.
You wish to turn your coat?
If you must put it that way, yes.
What do you suggest I have to gain from this?
First, a means to work against my current employer. Jerome and I aren't the only agents set against you. Our job is the vault, and nothing else. All the information we gather on your operations is being passed to someone else. They're waiting for us to come up with a means to crack your money box, and then they've got further plans for you.
Go on.
The other benefit would be mutual. I want a job. I'm tired of running from city to city chasing after work. I want to settle in Talvera, find a home, maybe a woman. After I help you deal with my current employer, I want to work for you, here.
As an entertainer, perhaps?
You need a floor boss, Requin. Tell me truly, are you as complacent about your security as you were before I came up your stairs? I know how to cheat every single game that can be cheated here, and if I weren't sharper than your attendants, I'd already be dead. Who better to keep your guests playing fairly?
Your request is logical. Your willingness to shrug off your employer isn't. Don't you fear their retribution?
Not if I can help you put us both beyond it. Identification is the problem. Once identified, any man or woman in the world can be dealt with. You have every gang in Talvera under your thumb, and you have the ear of the Priori. Surely you could make the arrangements if we could come up with names.
And your partner, Master de Ferra?
We've worked well together, said Locke, but we quarrelled not long ago over an intensely personal matter. He believes his insult is forgiven. I assure you it is anything but. I want to be quits with him when our current employer is dealt with. I want him to know before he dies that I've had the best of him. If possible, I'd like to kill him myself. That and the job are my only requests.
What do you think of all this, Selendri?
Some mysteries are better off with their throats slit, she whispered.
You might fear that I'm trying to displace you, said Locke. I assure you, when I said floor boss, I meant floor boss. I don't want your job.
And you could never have it, Master Costa, even if you did want it.
Requin ran his fingers down Selendri's right forearm and squeezed her undamaged hand.
I admire your boldness only to a point.
Forgive me, both of you. I had no intention of presuming too much. Selendri, for what it's worth, I agree with you. In your position, getting rid of me might seem like wisdom. Mysteries are dangerous to people in our profession. I am no longer pleased with the mystery of my employment. I want a more predictable life. What I ask and what I offer are straightforward.
And in return, said Requin, I receive possible insight into an alleged threat against a vault I have enhanced by my own design to be impenetrable.
A few minutes ago, you expressed the same confidence concerning your attendants and their ability to spot card sharps.
Have you penetrated my vault security as thoroughly as you say you've danced around my attendants, Master Costa? Have you penetrated it at all?
All I need is time, said Locke. Give it to me, and a way will make itself plain sooner or later. I'm not giving up because it's too hard. I'm giving up because it pleases me. But don't just take my word on my sincerity. Look into the activities of Jerome and myself. Make inquiries about everything we've been doing in your city for the past 2 years. We have made some progress that might open your eyes.
I shall, said Requin. And in the meantime, what am I to do with you?
Nothing extraordinary, said Locke. Make your inquiries. Keep your eyes on Jerome and myself. Continue to let us play at your spire. I promise to play more fairly, at least for the coming few days. Allow me to think on my plans and gather whatever information I can about my anonymous employer.
Let you walk out of here unscathed? Why not hold you somewhere secure while I exercise my curiosity about your background?
If you take me seriously enough to consider any part of my offer, said Locke, then you must take the possible threat of my employer seriously as well. Any tip-off to them that I've been compromised, and Jerome and I might be cast loose. So much for your opportunity.
So much for your usefulness, you mean. I am to take a great deal on faith from a man offering to betray and kill his business partner.
You hold my purse as surely as your desk held my hand. All the coin I have in Tal Verar I keep here with your sin spire. You may look for my name at any counting house in the city, and you will not find it. I give you that leverage over me willingly.
A man with a grudge, a genuine grudge, might piss on all the white iron in the world for one chance at his real target, Master Costa. I have been that target too many times to forget this.
I am not crass, said Locke, taking back one of his decks of cards from Requin's desktop. He shuffled it a few times without looking at it. Jerome insulted me without good cause. Pay me well and treat me well, and I will never give you any reason for displeasure. Locke whisked the top card off his desk, flipped it, and set it down face up beside the remnants of Requin's dinner. It was the Master of Spires. I deliberately choose to throw in with you, if you'll have me. Place a bet, Master Requin. The odds are favorable. Requin pulled his optics out of his coat pocket and slipped them back on. He seemed to brood over the card. Nothing was said by anyone for some time. Locke sipped quietly from his glass of wine, which had turned pale blue and now tasted of juniper.
Why, said Requin at last, all other considerations aside, should I allow you to violate the cardinal rule of my spire on your own initiative and suffer nothing in exchange?
Only because I imagine that cheaters are ordinarily discovered by your attendants while other guests are watching, said Locke, attempting to sound as sincere and contrite as possible. Nobody knows about my confession outside this office. Selendry didn't even tell your attendants why they were hauling me up here.
Requin sighed, then drew a gold solari from within his scarlet coat and set it down atop Locke's Master of Spires. I shall hold fast with a small wager for now, said Requin. Do anything unusual or alarming, and you will not survive long enough to reconsider. At the slightest hint that anything you've told me has been a lie, I will have molten glass poured down your throat.
That seems fair.
How much money do you currently have on the ledger here?
Just over 3,000 solari.
2,000 of that is no longer yours. It will remain on the ledger so Master De Ferra doesn't get suspicious, but I'm going to issue instructions that it is not to be released to you. Consider it a reminder that my rules are not to be broken on anyone's recognition but my own.
Ouch! I suppose I should be grateful. I mean, I am. Thank you.
You walk on eggshells with me, Master Costa. Step delicately.
Then I may go, and I may think of myself as in your service?
You may go. And you may consider yourself on my sufferance. We will speak again when I know more about your recent past. Selendry will accompany you back down to the first floor. Get out of my sight.
With an air of faint disappointment, Selendry folded the brass fingers of her artificial hand up until it was whole once again and the blades were hidden.
She gestured toward the stairs with that hand, and with the look in her good eye she told him precisely how much patience she had to spare for him if Requin's should start to wane.